Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of
woodworking.
I'm Guy from Guy's Woodshop, and as always, I'm joined by my friends Hui Huynh, also known as the Alabama Woodworker.
Good evening today. Evening. Sunday.
Good evening, Hui. And Brian Schmidt.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good evening.
What are you in Australia? No.
Hey, mate.
All right. Well, this podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things on our own shops. And we also have a Patreon account. Right now, we have one level, and we're simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the cost of bringing you this podcast. So please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife. And we'd also like to thank our newest patron for their pledge, Sam Harrison. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you,
and we sincerely hope that you give us your support. Also, stay tuned at the end of the show to hear about what we've got going on in our shops. Let's get right into it. Hui!
All right.
Go.
This evening, I've got a question from Derek. He says, hello, gentlemen. Great woodworking podcast. I am in the market for a drum sander. Currently, I have a Jet 2244. It is a love-hate relationship with all the known issues. The budget would be around $2,000 to $3,000. Good budget for a drum sander. I was thinking open-ended Powermatic 2244 or something similar that is close-ended. Also, would you recommend a single or a double? What about finding bigger 37-inch or a similar from Shop Liquidations? I know there is wiring and things that, or I think what he means there is wiring considerations to think about. Like I said, I have a hobby workshop with some 220 equipment. Like I mentioned again, hobby workshop, maybe it will grow into something more, maybe not. I originally got the open-ended sander, hoping that this would send wider boards through, stupidly, tabletops, but obviously it is not as easy as it would seem to be. I do not know if that helped or made my question more murky. Sometimes there are good deals on Facebook Marketplace, but these deals do not last very long. There was a Grizzly G1066R for $1,300. That's actually a pretty good price if it was in good condition. And now I regret not buying it. Any suggestions would help. Thank you. So it sounds like what Derek has now is the Jet 2244. And I've known some issues with the Jet 2244 because I don't believe that machine has the ability to account for wider boards if there's some misalignment in or coplanarity between the drum and the table. I don't know if that's a...
I don't think that's a word.
Yeah. Well, to get them to be parallel with each other.
You could just say like just coplanar and be done with it.
Coplanar, yeah. So, I've known issues with that. $2,000 to $3,000, man, I don't have much experience in the market of these sanders, but I have an open-ended drum sander. And what I'm sort of worried about with regards to your question is why is that you're not able to get a wider tabletop through there? I mean, even if it is a little bit out of alignment or not coplanar or has some sort of cantilever effect to it because it's open-ended, that amount over the course of a tabletop is just going to be a small ridge, which you can hand sand out. So it shouldn't be that much of an issue because I have an open-ended Supermax. I think Supermax is the name of the company or what the Supermax name of the company used to be. And I've never had that significant of an issue putting wider boards through my 1936. Guy, have you had a lot of issues with when you had the Supermax?
This is like a real can of worms with these sanders. So he's talking about several different sanders here, like the Jet 2244. It's cantilever design, meaning one end of it's open.
Mm-hmm.
That does something that none of these other printers do, which is oscillate.
Sanders. You said printers.
Sanders. Sanders do. It oscillates.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That is a big deal. Anybody that has a drum sander, I've got a Powermatic 2244, which is a just wonderful, wonderful piece of equipment. However, it's a straight line, single roll, boom, right. You put it through, and it leaves scratch marks that are, you've got to get them out of there. And it actually takes a little bit. The thing with that particular sander, I found anyways, I use it to flatten things. I don't use it to sand things.
Yeah.
It still takes a lot of sanding afterwards. It just gets it flat. And if you sand correctly, you won't dish anything. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, the jet with the oscillating head is a big deal. On the Powermatic, mm-hmm. I'm going to go on here for a little bit. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
The Powermatic is a great sander, and it has one thing the competition doesn't in this price range, actually a little bit more expensive, is the digital readout. Now, at first, I thought that was a gimmick. Mm-hmm. It's not. When you can control, you know, like an extra 2 or 3 thousandths of an inch just by pressing a button, it's huge.
And it's pretty accurate to that as well.
It's fairly accurate. It's not a, you know, a $50,000 machine, but it's close. It's close enough. So that's a big deal, because that's all you're really taking off per pass. People think you're going to these drum sanders are thicknessers. They're not. Mm-hmm. That's what a planer is for. Yeah. So when you start getting up into the bigger machines, like he's talking about a 37 inch or even larger, like a 52 or 53, those are big, expensive machines that have tons of pneumatics in it. And all those machines, you know, especially like what's the Italian? Like an SCM machine, which is really prevalent.
I know. All the Euro names, like MSI or something. I don't know.
Yeah. But there's a lot there's a lot of these machines out there, and they all have these weird ass proprietary parts that you can only get from them. They're very expensive machines to maintain. When they work well, but you got to remember they don't oscillate. So even if you have to run it through a couple times, you're only taking off, like I said, like 2 or 3 thousandths of an inch at a time. You put up a tabletop through there, you have to put it through 20 times.
Yeah. It's still going to be difficult. Yeah, just
it's a lot.
What I gather, Guy, is what you're saying is even having a higher end machine, you're going to have to hand sand afterwards.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
See, that's why I'm so confused about he's saying he's having issues with the 2244. Like, what kind of issues? Like, I still have to hand sand when I use my open-ended machine, you know, and even if it leaves a small ridge, I can feather that out.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. It's when it's off considerable amounts, so you do have to do a little bit of calibration to it. But as far as that goes, I'm a fan of the cantilever style or the open-ended sanders, because I can't put mine being a 44, which I think is a sweet spot. Mm-hmm. I can put a 42-inch tabletop through it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the main reasons, because I had the PowerMax 1938 also.
Yeah.
And I upgraded the PowerMatic, and I was really darn glad I did, just for that fact.
Yeah.
Because it's just a little bit, it goes to 11.
Yeah, but it doesn't take as much, it takes about the same amount of footprint as the other machine.
Yeah.
It's Brian, not that much more. Sorry, Brian, we hadn't included you at all.
Yeah, Brian's up there. He's falling asleep. I just thought I'd wake him up. What do you think about all this?
I think it's great that you guys have drum sanders. I wish I had one.
So. Yeah. Can I ask this? Are there any dual head open-ended sanders? I think all the dual head sanders are going to be closed end. Am I right on that?
Yeah, those are like 25 inch usually.
That's not wide enough for a tabletop.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
But you can sand your part. You know, we have this one at work that's a 53-inch, and it actually has a 53-inch helical head as a planer in front of it.
Right.
We can take off a quarter inch of material and sand it to 120 off the other side. It's just tremendous. So even when we're making parts for like cabinets and stuff, they just go through that thing. They come out. It's like, all right. So you're working with pre-sanded parts.
Right.
And that's such a luxury. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing a lot of people don't realize you can do with these drum sanders. You can pre-sand your parts. before you glue them up or do joinery.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a nice thing. But you should Brian.
We have not included you on this conversation at all. We're sorry about this. Go ahead, man.
No, 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 no. Oh, sorry. I don't have anything to add. I think I might have just been scratching my head. I don't.
Yeah. So wait a minute. Let me ask you, those, let's not say necessarily the helical head machine that you guys have, but like other industrial type bigger. Right. So does that require three phase or are those single phase?
Before that, 220? we had a 52 inch. Mm-hmm. Dual drum, and it's a big machine.
So the dual drums that are like 24 inches, like this Grizzly that he mentioned that he found on Facebook Marketplace, because I think that machine is within his price range budget that he had. I think those are only those are 220 machines, right? So I guess the closed end up to like about 24 inches, maybe even 36 inches, probably take just 220. I don't know. You've got to do some research on this, but the Powermatic that you have, Guy, the 2244 is 220, not three phase, right? Because the Supermax that I have
it's 110.
It's 110, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's only like a 1 horsepower motor or something like that.
Okay.
I can't remember. Yeah. So.
Well, anyway, hopefully that helps you in your search, Derek. We're going to move it along to Brian.
All right, this question is from Brian, spelled with a Y, not an I. This is not from me. And Brian says, I have a question for you about gluing up table aprons, and I'm mostly referring to large dining tables. The aprons I'm making are generally with 8/4 stock, roughly 4 inches wide. I can manage to get the legs and aprons milled and cut square. All my joinery is with dominoes. Whenever I do the glue up, everything is slightly out of square despite everything being square prior to glue up. I have pipe clamps and parallel clamps and have tried both. For some reason, I can't get the clamping pressure positioning right. Any tips would be appreciated. So, Brian, my first recommendation would be to, if you think you've got your stock milled and cut square, I would go to your domino and do some testing and fitting of the domino and see if it's actually seating at 90 degrees square to the surface that you're putting it into. I was watching a YouTube video the other day and they might have been Keith Johnson, and he had plunged out for dominoes and he realized he hadn't gotten his fence all the way back to square. Mm-hmm. And he had seated them at, 88 degrees or something like that, which, will end up sending it out of square. So I would do
a little bit out of square.
Yeah. So I would check on that. The only other thing, maybe it is square and maybe it's a clamping issue. I'll take one shot at maybe a clamping solution. When you measure corner to corner, I always measure corner to corner on anything I'm clamping that I want to be rectangular or square, just to make sure my corner to corner measurement is the exact same. And if you find that you're getting a longer read from corner A to corner C than you are from corner B to corner D, then you can put a little bit of cross clamping pressure from corner A to corner C and pull that in closer, which will naturally force the other two out and get your thing closer to square.
Yeah.
Guy, what approach would you take here if he's having trouble getting everything?
I'm going to let Hui go, because again, okay, I have a long-winded answer that I'm going to apologize for ahead of time. Go ahead, Hui.
There are two things that I'd consider in his approach. The first being applying clamps and clamping pressure on sub-assemblies. That tends to be a lot easier for me to manage, and then therefore it's a lot easier to maintain square between the two sub-assemblies. So for instance, the front and the back of the apron, let's say a long rectangular table, right? So you have with four apron boards, right? The long side and the short side. I would clamp together the sub-assembly of this long side and making sure that I'm applying the clamping pressure or the actually doing the assembly on a relatively flat surface. And I use quotation marks for relatively flat, the flattest that you can get it. It doesn't have to be super flat, but the way you assemble and the way you clamp them together and the surface that you clamp them on is going to make a big difference. Finally, once you have the two sub-assemblies, it makes it a lot easier to put those two sub-assemblies back together or fully together with the other two halves of the apron. And that's about all I think I can offer in terms of just making the clamping application process easier as opposed to trying to do it all at once. Guy, anything you can add to that? I'm sure.
Yes. I've had the pleasure of building lots of very large tables. And I know what he's talking about. In the words of Jimmy DiResta, if it looks square, it is square. When you've got a table apron that's for a 14-foot table that's 12 feet long, right okay? On. If you can tell that's an inch out of square with the naked eye, with a tabletop on it, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm telling you. So you don't want to be an inch out of square. What's more important than anything else is you want to make sure the joints are closed.
Sure. Yeah.
If over that he does specify that this is mostly large dining tables. He's using 8-quarter stock for the aprons. That's that's an inch and a half thick. Two inches thick. So close the joints. If it's within a half an inch of square over 6 feet, I'm good with that. I want my joints to be closed. You're not going to be able to see that. Because unless something else is dependent on that being square, which it isn't, you can attach that to the top. No problem. Nobody will notice it. You know, a quarter inch to a 3/8 of an inch off. It's not a big deal. Close the joints. Yep. That's my advice.
Right on. So when I did a big conference table, one of the things that I actually did was I assembled the aprons on site there and just clamped it there and then just took that seemed to get it at least flat to the surface that, I was clamping it to. And it was it didn't rock that large conference table. Anyway, Brian, anything?
No, I think that's great advice.
Oh, yeah. What's we started with advice? You.
Yeah.
I like the first advice. It goes on to Guy. Right. My bad.
It's all right. This question comes from Roger Martin, as a matter of fact. And he says, I have listened to all your podcasts and very much enjoy and learn from them. All right. He says, ours is by far the best out of the three he listens to. Well, thank you.
That's awesome.
I have to confess, I am a wood hoarder. I do a lot of small projects, scroll saw boxes and the like, and end up with small pieces left over that should be good for something. How do I organize them and what size is too small in your opinion to be useful? The same applies to pieces left over after building furniture or other large projects. Do I just throw everything in the burn pile? Is there a logical way to sort and store small pieces of lumber? That is another Pandora's box if we open it.
Let's open it up.
I confess to being somewhat of a wood hoarder too. Really? It depends on what I'm making. If I've got a couple drawers in the 100 or so drawers I have in my shop that have a lot of small pieces that might be, 4 or 5 inches square, 1/4 inch thick kind of stuff. I look at it and I go, I might need that for something. And I throw it in the drawer. When that drawer gets full, then I dump.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll keep like 3 or 4 pieces and dump the rest. I have a wood bin, like a scrap bin that I have in one corner of my shop over by my wood pile. Same thing. as I get done with pieces, I throw them in there. When it gets overflowing, I dump it. I keep, right, you know, a couple pieces of each species and I dump the rest. And it's mm-hmm. a cycle.
Yep.
So that's how I do it.
Yep. Yep. So you pick through it as you need it, right?
Yeah, as I need it for like other stuff. Yep. But yep. I mean, you can save as much as you darn well want to. There just comes a point in time where it becomes too much for your storage space. Dump it and start anew.
Yep.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I don't know if I call myself a wood hoarder. I think I have a lot of wood, but I think I do a pretty good job of sending it to the burn pile when it's too small or too random to use. One thing that I have found really useful in my own shop is I have a 24-inch deep cabinet. I'm looking at it right now. It's probably only 15 inches wide and 30 inches tall, and it's got four shelves to it. And in this, I've got all of my little short cutoff pieces, and whatever I can put in there is what I keep. And it's kind of like what you were saying, Guy, except mine are maybe a little bigger than your 4 or 5 inch square pieces. And if I have more than what can fit up there, then I need to take the least valuable of it and mm-hmm. put it in the burn bin, and it burns great outside in the fire pit. So I'm really anti shop clutter. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time staying focused when I've got stuff strewn about everywhere. So organization and applying 5S principles are a really important thing for me. The lumber storage is a really key piece to that, because if I've got boards hanging, you know, leaning up against the wall here, there, and everywhere, I just find it really hard to stay focused.
Yeah, like I said, there's nothing wrong with keeping stuff, but it just gets to a point where this is the space I've allocated for it.
Yep.
It's outgrown it.
Yep.
I got to purge.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I try to keep it very project specific. A lot of my projects are very long dwells, so it ends up being that the scrap pile that I have is more project specific. Now, obviously there are some pieces, like I've got some tiger maple pieces that are like, you know, 8-quarter thick that might be nice turning blanks or something like that I keep on hand. But for the most part, it's very project specific. And then outside of that, sometimes projects are so long that I end up having to like purge mid project, in which case I call my buddies that do a lot of cutting boards. I've got about 3 of them, and I just cycle them through and just call them, and they come and pick up my scrap bin, and they use it for cutting boards and all sorts of things that they figure out. And maybe they have burn bins too, but at least I'm supplying their burn bin somewhat. So
yeah, that's what I do. That's a really good piece of advice. Whenever I'm doing a project, I've talked about this before, whenever mm-hmm. I'm doing a project, I save all the scraps. Yeah. Until I'm done with the project and it has finish on it and it's complete. Other than that, I'm keeping everything. If it's over 12 inches long and more than 2 inches wide, I'm keeping it.
Keeping it for that project.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's good to have little pieces of this, that, and the other thing to fix stuff you break, because, mm-hmm. you know, things get ruined sometimes and you have to repair them.
And even clamping blocks and whatnot for jigs. I just reuse that stuff.
So. Yeah, but I'm talking about keeping the parts for the project you're working on in case you need them for the project you're working on.
100%. Yep.
Yeah, because some of those boards are, you know, the different colors and everything. So.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Repairs, things like that. All sorts of things. Yeah. Replacement parts.
All right. Well, I hope that helps you out, Roger. And we're shooting it back to you.
Okay. So this is a relatively quick question, I think, but we can expound on it. Jay Beggs, he asks, when using white oak for trim, what fasteners can I use that won't cause the tannins in the white oak to react to the metal of the fasteners? Thanks, guys. So if you guys aren't familiar out there in podcast world, aren't familiar, white oak has a relatively high tannin content. And tannins are basically these, the coloration and the chemicals within the wood that end up reacting with ferrous materials. So for instance, if you've got iron, any type of iron in the fastener, what that'll do is actually oxidize with the tannins in the white oak and then discolor the white oak where it actually looks black, almost, it's not bleaching. It's when you use ammonia with white oak.
Fuming,
yes. You can kind of get those dark spots, even darker than what fuming would have. So using any type of galvanized pin nail or galvanized screw basically has like a zinc coating on it will definitely help in preventing tannin discoloration in your white oak. Brian, do you guys have any experience with this? Have you guys dealt with any oxidation or discoloration of white oak due to the tannins reacting with iron or any types of metals?
I've not had any issues. I shot some regular old pin nails in a face frame of a white oak bookcase. It's up in my kid's room. It's only a couple months old though, so maybe that's not enough time for anything to happen. I'm not sure if the combination there would create any sort of discoloration, but so far so good.
Yeah, I imagine that the pin nails or the brad nails that you had might have had some type of zinc coating on them, in which case they're not going to react with that white oak or shouldn't react with that white
oak. They're galvanized.
Yeah.
That's what the zinc coating is. It's galvanization. And mm-hmm. It's steel. It's not iron. Steel is not as I think, as ferrous as iron. Iron is where the big problem happens.
Correct.
But
iron content.
Galvanized steel pin nails are a non-issue.
Yeah. So that's about all I can say about that. Guy, do you have anything to add? If not, then it's off to Brian with his second question.
No, not really. I mean, it's a good question.
Yeah.
You just have to be careful of what kind of fastener you're using. As long as it's like a galvanized steel or something like that, and it's not huge. Yep. I mean, it's not a big deal. Pin nails. I wouldn't even hesitate using brad nails,
right?
Like 18 gauge brad nails. I don't think mm-hmm. would be an issue at all. I've done it before and I've never had a problem. And some of my stuff is, 20, 30 years old.
Right. And it just has to be galvanized, which will have some type of zinc coating on it. So,
yeah. Yeah. So, all right.
Good. Brian?
Brian, all right. Goes to you.
My second question is from Paul Genero. Paul at Twin Lakes Workshop writes, "Hello, everyone. Wanted your advice on dados and what I may be doing wrong. When I cut the dado and mating piece, I make sure to get a good tight fit during the dry fit. My issue comes up when I'm sanding. I'll take all the pieces apart and sand them to the desired sand grit, 180 or 220, depending on finish. But when I go to glue up my mating piece, it's now loose in the dado. Should I be making the dado smaller? Should I just wait to sand till it's all glued up? Or do you have any other advice? Thanks, Paul at Twin Lakes Workshop." So Paul, what I do, and I don't know if this is a good technique or not, but it seems to work well for me, is if I am going to be cutting dados or grooves, what I will do is I will actually take a real thin piece of painter's tape and tape off the portion that's going to be seated in that groove, so that when I get to sanding, I've got that visual of making sure I don't sand all the way over onto the edge of the board, and it'll start to show some wear if I'm getting too close, and that keeps it me from sanding it down too thin to where now it's a loose fit in there. I've done that enough times that I started using that painter's tape, and I got some from StuMac, which provides supplies for luthiers. And I've got a couple different rolls that are fairly thin depending on how much is going to go in there. So I can just apply it and be done. So nice. What do you do?
So I do the same thing, man, right there. And in fact, actually, I do that quite a bit for pre-finishing the insides of things. So I'll tape off glue or mating joints. And if I need to finish with shellac or something, the inside, just to get that done before everything is assembled and I do a final spray on the whole assembly, I like to glue off those mating joints. And when I, particularly when I have joints that are fitting properly, I don't want to remove any more additional material. And so then I'm using blue painter's tape, the same trick that you're talking about there. So yeah, good on you. Guy, what you got?
I'm a school of thought for a lot of that stuff, right? I'll sand it after the glue up.
Okay. Right on.
I don't know if that's the answer. But I understand pre-finishing and things like that. There's times when I don't. There's times when I do. And it really depends on what I'm doing.
Right.
I guess you could, you know, I have pre-finished parts before. And if I'm going to be doing that, then I do what you're talking about, which is tape off the area that's going to go in there. That way I don't sand it, or I don't get finish on where the glue joint is.
Right.
So that's a good practice also. However, there are times when we just forget to do stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Glue's on it, you're sticking together. It's like, oh, damn it. So in that case, I just sand it. It requires a little bit more hand sanding to get, especially getting the corners and such.
Sure.
But as long as you don't sand against the grain in that corner, you're fine.
Right. Right.
So.
Good. Well, Paul, I hope that helps.
Oh, it's over to me for the last question already?
Yep.
Oh, my. Well, this question comes from Sam. It says, hey there, fellas. I'm with a small furniture and cabinet shop called Silt Studio in Atlanta. Love the podcast and the great wealth of information you guys bring to the world of woodworking. He asked a question about the relevance of the table saw. He said he has a Powermatic 2000. He says, I know Guy loves his, with a 5x5 outfeed and a 36 inch rail extension. So that's like, what, 50 some inches, 52 inches?
Yeah, it's a good size table saw.
Yeah. It's really been a great workhorse for our shop. The space is about 3,000 square feet, which is big. And we are quickly outgrowing the footprint for the amount of kitchen and cabinet jobs we're taking on. There are also columns on a 9x14 foot grid pattern to the space, so the space isn't wide open.
Yeah, right.
We're talking about getting a large slider to facilitate the speedier and more accurate square cuts. Currently, we're ripping down sheet goods with our Festool track saw and finishing with the table saw. If we get a slider, a large chunk of our milling cutting space would be taken up. Is it worth keeping the Powermatic and just losing the outfeed to save space? Or can we do everything we need to do on the slider? We're considering the Laguna 1218 model slider. Looking forward to your thoughts. Thanks so much. I took this question because I am a convert to the sliding panel saw for everything. If you've got that and a router table or a router, you're golden, especially if you're in a cabinet shop. Being able to break down 8 to 14 sheets of plywood into all your cabinet parts in less than an hour and a half, 2 hours, is tremendous. And they're all perfectly square. It's just, you put a sheet on there, you clean an edge off, you go zip, 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 and you're done.
Yeah.
It's it works really, really fast. If you've got two people working it, loading, cutting, taking off, stacking, stuff like that, you can make a house full of cabinets. You can cut up the plywood in under 2 hours.
Yeah.
So compare that to doing it with a track saw, which I've done many times because I don't have a sliding table saw or table saw at home. So I've been there spending a whole day breaking down 4 or 5 sheets of plywood into parts, either using some kind of guide system for the rail or just cutting it large and then cutting it again. If you're a cabinet shop and you're concerned about making money, spend the money and get the sliding table saw. You will never regret it. You can do anything that you can do on a regular table saw with the exception of dados. You can do on the slider.
My guess is that his cabinet shop, based on what they're doing, they're probably not doing that many dados. I wouldn't imagine.
It's a cabinet shop. You're not doing dados. You're just button that thing up and driving screws in through the sides.
Yeah.
So, the slider. Get the slider. Get the slider. Get the slider. Get the slider.
Yeah. Time is money, and the inefficiency involved with bringing it down with the track saw and finishing it on the table saw.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It's fun, but it takes so long.
That's fun.
Well, yeah, I like woodworking. You know, I don't care what I'm doing. Yeah. I have fun doing it.
I mean, but the cabinets, I mean, you're what, 20? Well, it depends on what you're using, but 23 and a half, right? So everything is, you need to process a lot of wood.
Yeah.
And you're not making like super complex cuts that are, you know, you just got to slap sheets up there and get finished cuts off of it. Laguna's nice.
What were you going to say, Brian? What would you want?
No, I was just wondering one of his concerns is the space that he loses. He said, I lost it. I'm sorry. The milling, a larger chunk of their milling cutting space would be taken up. Is it worth keeping the Powermatic and just losing the outfeed to save space, or can we do everything we need to on the slider with that Laguna P12-8 industrial model slider? So do you have any concerns from a milling and cutting standpoint? I guess if that's going to do pretty much everything they need to do, then the larger footprint, you know, is justified from a milling and cutting standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole thing is when I first started using that, I said, well, we got to do this and this and this. And we got a nice, dado blade for the saw stop we had, and you know, it's great, but I just never use it anymore.
Yeah.
Once I figured out how to, it's a completely different animal using the big panel saws, because it's your body's in a different position. You have to get used to how it feels. But once you get used to it, it's like, I come home and use my saw and it's like, ugh.
Can I ask you something? I know Ramon Valdez does this, where he has the smaller slider. He has the K3 or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not a small one. But could they put the Powermatic on the outfeed side of that slider if they needed to run dados or something?
Keeping a saw that big to run dados is silly.
Okay.
If they're talking about making cabinets out of plywood, they're not making dados anyways.
Right, right.
So the few times you do need to make dados, do it on the router table.
Sure. Yeah. Or shaper or something like that. I don't know.
Something like that. I would just do it on a router table. You just do it with a handheld router. I mean, it doesn't take that much.
Right, right. Yeah, and if they have a Festool, track, then they could use a track if they really need to make a long dado or something like that.
But I mean, having the panel and panel saw and a cabinet shop is a must.
Yeah, Guy, having used the slider that we have at work, do you find that it is easier, maybe safer, to manage sheets of plywood and breaking them down and cutting them on the tracks on, then potentially taking, you know, a 72 inch long section for a big tall upper cabinet?
Yeah. So being an old fart, being the old guy at work, every time I go grab a big sheet of plywood, I've got five guys coming. Let me help you. I'm like, no, I'm okay. Because I know how to use it to my advantage. So the weight to my advantage and leverage. The way those saws are, they're designed to have the panel. You just slide it off. If you keep your lumber, you know, horizontal or vertical, you just need to get it vertical, slide it over on the floor, and then you can push it right up against the slider and then tilt it up. So even an old decrepit fart like me can get an 8-foot sheet of plywood on there and off the stack. Really super easy with absolutely no hassle at all. Yeah. And usually what you're doing is let's say you're making a bunch of cabinets and you're making, you know, 15 cabinets. Mm-hmm. I know I need this many linear feet of the 23 and a quarter inch stock. You know what I mean? So yeah. I just start running all the sheets.
Yeah.
To get that number. And that's what you do. You do a bunch of rips. You do a bunch of rips. You do a bunch of cross cuts. You do a bunch of cross cuts. And then you just got all your parts and you go, boom, you're done.
Done.
It's really easy to do. You only have to set up the saw a couple, three times when you're doing stuff like that. So, but it's so much faster. It's so much better. Good. I don't know if it's safer, but it's definitely faster.
I'm just thinking the physical stress of trying to manhandle a 4x8 sheet of plywood and get it up onto, you know, table. So, okay, good.
But no, it's easy. What I'm saying is
No. I'm talking about the track saw.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I'm doing it at home, because I go from track saw to table saw at my shop here at home. And I'm 6'4" with big, long arms, not strong arms, just long arms.
Your ceiling's only 5 feet.
Yeah. It's a bit of a bear. So, okay.
But I stopped doing the cutting it rough and then cutting it with the table saw when I got done. I just did everything with the track saw.
Yeah, but having a panel saw would take that out.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is if you don't have that and you're using the track saw, just use the track saw. There's no reason to use the table saw. Get yourself some guide rails, dedicated ones that you make yourself, stick them on there and say, you know, this is my rip for this size and this is my rip for this size, and just go to town with that.
Yeah.
And cut them with that instead of cutting them twice. That, to me, that is really, you can't do that in a cabinet shop.
Yeah.
You can't cut things twice.
That's even cut them right the first
time. Cut them the right size the first time.
Right.
So. All right. I guess that's it for the questions. That one quick.
Yeah.
All right. So what do you got going on in the shop, Ryan?
Getting ready to do installation on a 16-foot wall of built-ins. I made a canned good storage for our pantry. We had kind of an inside wall to our pantry where the door opens to. And I took a bunch of leftover ash plywood, and I can hold 100 canned goods on this canned goods storage. It's I don't know. Betraying my OCD tendencies here for organization.
You all get excited about something.
Yeah, and helping a couple neighbors and friends, well, they're neighbors, but friends with cabinet projects in their own house too. So a lot of sawdust, nothing too terribly exciting, but a lot of sawdust, which I'm grateful for.
Right. We will be working.
My wife had a baby February 22nd. So
congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Vivian, our baby girl, our third. Yeah. So we had a baby.
So but you haven't I haven't been have, making anything.
Well,
other than babies.
Yeah. I've been doing a little bit of sanding and a little bit of dyeing of this walnut, china cabinet. So I did do a little bit of sanding. I did some dyeing. So
all right. Yeah, it's probably good to get out in the garage for a little bit now and then right now.
Every now. Just for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Yeah, just please. Just 10 minutes. 10 minutes of free time.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything because I was on vacation last week. So I was gone. I wasn't even at home. So I got nothing done. Yes. Yes,
good.
I'm surprised I came back. So
we're glad you're back.
Yeah, I'm glad to be going back to work tomorrow, believe it or not.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that's going to do it for the show. And would like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really does help us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. Please remember this podcast is here to answer questions from you, the woodworking community. So if you have woodworking questions you would like answered, You can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. And I can be found at Guy's Shop on YouTube and Guy's Woodshop just about everywhere else. Where can you be found, Wee?
AlabamaWoodworker.com, and all the links to my socials are on my website. And Brian?
I am not on traditional social media. I'm going to throw out a request to our listeners. So this is going back to the question submitting. We are getting down to on our list of questions. About a year ago, we got a nice inflow, and they come in steadily. But we do need some more questions. We're running a little low. So any questions you have that you have for your own shop or you think would make for great conversation on the podcast, please submit them through the methods that Guy recommended.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll talk to you guys in a couple weeks.
Talk to you in a couple.
All right. See ya.
Have a good one. Bye.
See ya. Bye.